Let's call this meeting to order so we can hear all those wonderful testimonies from Deed and Minnesota Housing Finance and find out all the wonderful budget adjustments we're making. We have a quorum now. Where's the minutes? Did you read the minutes already?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Key complete.
Okay, Representative Nelson approves the minutes of February 8th. All in favor of approving those minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposing, same sign. Motion carries. Who's first one? Commissioner Marks, see here. Minnesota Housing Finance. Sure, he can have you go. He has to leave at 9. Why don't you run out and see where he is? We got a posse going after him now.
Hello, sir.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. You got any good jokes for the committee this morning?
I could tell you about shopping a Mall of America joke, I know, but women would hate me. Just can't count on those commissioners, can you?
I think for every minute we should be moving money, you know, $1,000 a minute or...
Actually, he did enough of that himself. We don't have to help him.
Out of housing?
As long as it doesn't go in my district, I don't care.
Oh. So you wait till Representative Clark gets here. I'm going to tell her what you've been talking about.
Yeah. You've already heard me say that. More than one. So is Commissioner Marks.
Commissioner Marks, you can bring your coffee down the table, too.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Are we on television this morning?
Yeah. I hope not, for the commissioner's sake. And mine.
I thought you were going to have Commissioner Kramer warm you up for me.
No, I think you have to be somewhere at 9.
So I will do the same for him. Thank you.
I can almost give you a presentation for you.
Okay, well.
And members, this is a good time to get used to your budget book that they worked so hard to get it put together. What pages are we on, Ron?
Tab 3,
Minnesota Housing Finance. Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
We're looking forward to your enlightening testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. What I'd like to accomplish in a few moments is give you a brief overview of the governor's proposed budget as it relates to the Housing Finance Agency, focusing on the change items and the policy priorities that are reflected in it. As you know, this was a tough budget for many agencies, and it was required that we set forth priorities and principles by which we develop the budget in terms of allocating the appropriations and setting priorities. There are, I think, a number of groups and constituencies who have expressed concerns about the various results of the budget, but I think people are pretty aligned around the principles that were used to construct them. So I'd like to just briefly review those principles. First, we wanted to make sure that our programs, which assist the most vulnerable, be protected. Second, we wanted to continue to advance our strategic goals, two of which I'll highlight are ending long-term homelessness and assisting in increasing minority homeownership to address that homeownership gap. Third, we wanted to maximize contributions of non-state resources in terms of being able to maintain that as a priority, and that really affects our preservation programs where we maximize federal dollars. Third, we wanted to make sure that we prioritize activities that have no other source of funding for support. And where that really applies is that where we have had prepayments of loans, we have given those activities a lower priority, and that's primarily in rehabilitation and in homeownership assistance because we have other resources and prepayments that can be devoted to that. And finally, we gave lower priority to activities where there are other tools to achieve those policy ends. So that those are the set of principles that we use in order to provide recommendations to the governor and that are reflected in this budget. The result is that our base budget from last biennium of approximately $72 million is reduced to $57 million, $15 million reduction or 20%. Now, it should be remembered that as a part of the capital budget recommendation, the governor has recommended $20 million for supportive housing to advance the long-term homelessness initiative. We will be able to maintain all of our core programs as a result of this budget. As we continue to develop and understand the implications and work with our stakeholder groups, we will determine what programs may have to be reduced or restructured to accommodate these reduced appropriations. Those programs which do serve the most vulnerable were protected and did not receive cuts. And that includes the Family Homeless Prevention Program and the Bridges. And the business plan to end long-term homelessness in Minnesota, that plan is reflected in this budget in the sense that the $4 million is recommended for an increase to our housing trust fund specifically for that program. In addition, as a result of our having reduced appropriations, this helped facilitate two programs and initiatives of the Department of Human Services as part of their budget. One is a $10 million initiative that will provide flexible funding for support services for those in supportive housing. And that's a very important program and something that is very necessary in order for that plan to be advanced. In addition, the Department of Human Services has a $2.2 million recommendation for additional homeless prevention for children coming out of foster care to make sure that they have the support they need to get housing and don't end up on the streets. The major challenges in this budget will be, quite frankly, the reduction in the challenge program, which received about a 60% reduction from $19 million to $8 million. That is the bread and butter workforce housing program, which the agency has worked on and run for many years. We have financed approximately 500 housing projects in the last biennium with that. We get good leverage on that. But when you look at the principles that we apply, that is a program which serves relatively higher income individuals. And in addition, there are other means perhaps to achieve workforce housing and how we work with local communities on their zoning and density and other issues to accommodate workforce housing. That won't be a total answer, but it is part of the picture. In addition, the urban and tribal Indian housing programs, which have had separate line items the last several years, we are continuing the trend that we have put forward for many years to try to consolidate our programs, and so those tribal programs will be consolidated into the challenge program as a part of this budget. In terms of other changes, rehabilitation loans received a 33% reduction to $5.3 million. And finally, Affordable Rental Investment Fund for Preservation received an 8% reduction to $17 million. And again, in order to make sure that we are able to continue to promote homeownership and minority homeownership, we did maintain at the status quo of $1.5 million the homeownership education, training, and counseling program. In addition, it has been part of our base budget, homeownership assistance loans of about $1.7 million. That is not recommended to be a part of this next biennial budget as well, because of we're able to receive repayments and continue to provide that down payment assistance. I don't think that as interest rates rise, we're going to get those level of prepayments, so we'll likely have to be back to you in the future biennial for those resources. Again, Mr. Chair, members, this will allow us to maintain core programs. We will have to do things differently and perhaps restructure some things. And we will work with our stakeholders and constituency groups and our staff to be able to do that. Just a word about the President's budget, President Bush's proposed budget, as how it impacts housing. The overall budget for the Housing and Urban Development Department is being reduced 11.5% under the President's proposal to about $28.5 billion. The programs for which the Housing Finance Agency receives resources, a principal one is the HOME program. The President does propose a slight increase to the HOME program, but targets more of that money to down payment assistance. We get about $26, $27 million a biennia for the Housing Finance Agency for the HOME program, so that will be flat, I would suspect, as a result of the President's budget. We won't know that for a while. Another issue in the President's budget is continued effort to control costs and restructure the Section 8 housing voucher program. The President's budget suggests a slight increase for Section 8, but in terms of how it's going to be restructured and the increased demand for housing choice vouchers, that is going to be a challenge for affordable housing as we move forward. The governor has been very active in expressing concern about that program and will maintain an active role in working to preserve that program and make provide leadership so that there are necessary reforms. But that's an important part of our housing infrastructure. I think the good news in the President's proposed budget is that the President's budget is very aligned with this administration's and this state's goal to end homelessness. Homeownership assistance is allocated at $1.44 billion in the President's budget, up $200 million. And there is a special services fund as a part of the President's budget as well, similar to the one proposed in the Human Services budget, called the Samaritan Initiative, which is intended to provide the supportive services. I think another major concern as a part of the President's budget is the reduction to CDBG resources. The Small Cities Program, and Commissioner Kramer can talk about that, a lot of those resources are devoted to housing in Greater Minnesota, as well as the entitlement communities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Dakota County, Duluth, and others do rely on CDBG in large part for housing, and then we use our resources to leverage their resources to produce and maintain affordable housing. So that is a significant concern as we move forward. Mr. Chair, members, that is a brief overview of the budget, and I stand to take any questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Search.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You talked a bit. I want to ask you questions in two areas, but you talked a bit on the President's budget, and we discussed this in my office yesterday a bit as well. You listed a few areas where he actually increased the HUD budget. You talked a bit about CDBG
right.
as well. Can you tell us any other areas that you found yet where the decrease happened? Because there was a substantial decrease, in my opinion, in the HUD budget. Can you touched on some of the positives. Can you dive a little more into maybe some of where those cuts were and how that potentially could affect us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stewart, it's overall the HUD budget, the President's recommendation will reduce it by 11.5%. Mm-hmm. I think the major area where there is significant potential concern and really took the biggest cut was CDBG. Mm-hmm. And that's one I think we have to pay close attention to. The other ones, there was a lot of kind of collapsing of programs in terms of project-based Section 8 received a cut and other minor areas in the budget. But in terms of the one that I think has the most potential for posing real challenges for Minnesota communities as well as nationwide is the CDBG. And secondly, even though there was a slight increase in Section 8, given the rising costs of housing in many parts of the nation, whether that increase, as well as other change that the administration may propose, will allow us to maintain a strong program is an open question, and we'll be actively involved in that as the budget process in Washington unfolds.
Okay. Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other area that I'm concerned about is the housing stock in all of Minnesota, and especially in greater Minnesota. When I speak with companies, you know, some of the first things they do is they drive downtown, they see where the school is and the church is and the banks and the outdoor activities, but then they look at the housing stock for themselves and their potential employees. My sense is the Plante administration is making the decision, and we've got to decide this as well, of going for ending homelessness over workforce housing, rehabbing, and those sorts of things. Can you just touch a bit on the need that is out there, that if you can quantify the need out there for workforce housing, rehabbing homes, those sorts of things, especially as that pertains to the third cut?
Speaking of remarks. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, just to provide a little bit of context about how we're doing in housing overall, going back to my overview, we do have the highest home ownership rate in the nation, and we have the second lowest percentage of our households, 8% of any state in the country, who face critical housing needs, that is living in severely substandard housing or paying 50% or more for housing. So we're doing well. We, as a result of the last census data, commissioned with our partners a significant look at the census data and doing economic projections to what the need might be, and we projected that there was going to be a need for 115,000 new affordable housing units between 2000 and 2010, with a potential gap based upon what the private and public sectors working together through their natural course would be about 32,000 units, and about 25% of those are generally in greater Minnesota. I do think in greater Minnesota the greatest housing challenge is rehabilitation, maintaining that housing stock. And we do, in terms of the reductions in our programs, that took one of the smallest cuts for that reason. And in addition, we think that cut, given the parameters we were given, is justified because of the prepayments that we have received from appropriations that have been previously provided by this legislature that will allow us to maintain a strong rehabilitation program. The concerns that I have are the CDBG resources that Commissioner Kramer administers, because many of the cities that apply for and get those grants use those for housing rehabilitation in greater Minnesota communities. So that is an area of significant concern that we'll really have to monitor if we don't maintain those other resources for housing rehabilitation.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I don't know that this is necessarily within the mission of your area, but I have a tough time finding out who it is, because we generally talk about financing, and that usually means you make it affordable by putting some taxpayer money on the table. And I do a lot of discussions with builders, developers, planning agencies, and so forth. And if I can sort of get to the heart and maybe oversimplify, but I'm regularly hearing from them that we have if we want affordable housing, we have a very distorted system, because there's no motivation to really build from lots of kinds of ways the most affordable possible. I mean, I can't change the cost of wood and products, but I'm told constantly that we could build for a lot less. We do crazy things like establish energy codes that make houses so airtight that we have mold problems. Plus we were going to have ventilators bring in. It could have added $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 a house. In terms of planning, we had what I thought was a pretty nice plan in the neighborhood for modular homes, which are perfectly fine, but we had not in my backyard, and nobody showed up to advocate on behalf of affordable houses, say, you know what, we need this kind of stock. From a builder's point of view, so long as they've got marketplace and they can build $200,000-$300,000 houses and make a percentage profit, why would you bother, especially given the hassle? It's nice to have a lot more green space, but every time you do all those kinds of things, you're adding. Every dollar that's added to a development is ultimately going to be in that house. My basic question is, where is the advocacy for being able to build homes at a more affordable, lower cost level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, I think you're right on. And I think the issue is, as you suggested, it is part of many agencies and others' missions, and as a result, sometimes it doesn't get done very well. A couple of points. One, the housing industry, I have discovered, is pretty conservative. So to have the housing industry and the building community and the architectural community look seriously at new and different ways to make housing more affordable is a challenge. We're making strides. There's a lot of work at the university and funded by various grants that are starting to look at that. Second, we have the expectations of potential homeowners and renters who have a pretty high expectation of what housing means to them. And in today's market, where wages are flat or rising slightly and housing prices are going up more, we have to perhaps manage expectations. Third, it is the issue of community acceptance, both for the type of housing and how it looks and integrates into a community, the fees that are charged by our local communities, how much density we allow, are we allowing zoning for multifamily housing, and it is the NIMBY factor, all of which raise costs and constrain the ability to deliver affordable housing. And I think as a result of the reductions in our challenge program, we are going to have to raise those issues more aggressively because it is going to be more difficult to subsidize housing. We're going to have to wring costs out of it be more dense and work with communities and work with mayors and work with our partners such as the Metropolitan Council to try to bring these type of techniques throughout the state to achieve these housing needs. I think your question is right on, and I think we have to have a pretty significant statewide discussion on those issues.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Well, thank you very much for a great presentation. We appreciate your coming here.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And members, if any questions come up, Ms. Orr or Commissioner Marks will be very happy to come try to give you your answers. With that, Commissioner Kramer, welcome to our committee. First tab in your budget books, if anybody is following in that. Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Good morning. Mr. Chair, what I thought I would do is briefly give you a kind of a holistic approach to what we have done in the department, and then if you'd like, we could step through any of the individual budget recommendations. This was a very difficult budget for the department. As you know, the vast majority of our funds within the department are federal, and we have approximately some $90 million in state general funds. We've proposed approximately $17.1 million reduction in our state general fund appropriation, which is about 18.6% less than the previous biennium. The money is coming basically from two primary pots, one minor pot. The minor pot is direct economic development assistance. These are loans or grants, typically loans that we make to businesses around the state. We have the Minnesota Investment Fund, which is budgeted today at approximately $2.4 million for the biennium, and we're proposing to zero that out for the biennium. Not eliminate the statute, merely remove the money for this portion of the biennium. And if you'd like, members, again, in greater detail, I can tell you I feel very confident that we will have sufficient funds to continue to do lending for businesses around the state. We have several other resources, most notably the Agricultural and Economic Development Board, which is able to be able to make both smaller loans of less than $1 million, but also larger loans of $3 to $4 to $5 million for businesses around the state. And I happen to be chair of that board. Of the two major pots, the second one is our internal operations. As a result of the merger, we have everything from rent savings to IT savings. We also have some opportunities for consolidation. As you're aware, we have moved into one building now, the First National Bank building in downtown St. Paul. And a principal source of savings then has been this combined operations of the former DTED and the former DES. On the other side, the primary cuts are coming out of the youth programs, and we have several youth programs identified to eliminate for this biennium. I wouldn't for an instant say that these were easy choices. These are very tough choices for the department. These are good programs. They have value. But at the same time, our core mission is to stimulate and create economic development in the state. And many of the youth programs, as good as they are, don't have that as their primary charter, and thus was our rationale. Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I'd be happy to go through the individual programs in greater detail or open it up wide up for questions, whatever you prefer, sir.
Since we have so many new members of this committee, it'd probably be good to go through them with the...
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear what tab you're on, but within your tab, I'm on page 7 of our governor's recommendation, and this would be our first budget item. This is the elimination of a grant for the mortgage credit program. This is $250,000 a year, $500,000 for the biennium. This program was zeroed out in the previous biennium, but the enabling legislation was not removed. So this action is both to remove the funding entirely and make the statutory changes to eliminate the program. The program does not apply to low-income individuals. This is money that is used to assist three communities in the state, the city of St. Paul, the city of Minneapolis, and Dakota County, in administering the administrative costs associated with mortgage credits. Members, again, this was zeroed by the legislature in 2003-04, and while I wouldn't ask any of those three communities to come forward and say that it hasn't been a problem, it's instructive to note that they've made it through 2 years without asking for additional money in this case. When the money is split between the three communities, two members, I believe Dakota County gets approximately $15,000 a year. In fact, I have the exact numbers here. Dakota County gets approximately $15,000 a year. The city of St. Paul has been in the approximately $80,000 range, and the city of Minneapolis has been the remainder. So they've made it through 2003-04, and we're proposing to eliminate it for 2004-05. Again, it is only those three communities in the state. Mr. Chair, I'll move on to the second item then. If you turn to page 8 in your governor's recommendations, this is the elimination of funding for the Minnesota Investment Fund. Members, this is currently funded at $1.2 million per year, 2.4 for the biennium. In total, Minnesota businesses borrow over $50 billion a year throughout the state for commercial and industrial lending activities around the state. This is a very, very modest sum. Our average loan is $300,000 to $400,000, so in any given year, this is only 3 to 4 loans across the entire state. Members, in July of 2003, you gave the department the authority to make this a revolving loan fund. Before this, it had been primarily just grants. And as a revolving loan fund, it's been my instruction to the department that it was not just grants, but only made loans, with the hope that ultimately, as loans are repaid, we then have capital that we can reinvest in the state. So while this is a temporary setback to the department in terms of not having this additional money available, I'm also very confident that through the revolving loans we have coming back, as well as other sources of funding, both at the within the department, the Small Business Administration, and as Commissioner Marks noted, the community development block grants from the federal government that we typically harvest some portion of money for, we will have sufficient funds for businesses across the state.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. On the Minnesota Investment Fund, you know, having a limit, for all intents and purposes, we're eliminating it at the present time. If that one, you talk about the businesses borrowing more than $50 billion, I think you said, a year, but my guess is that includes an awful lot of large businesses in that dollar figure. And MIF was really designed for smaller businesses trying to get to be medium to larger sized businesses. And the intent of the program with the grants was to pretty much buy down the interest or to make a bridge loan. As I'm understanding it, this is a 25-year-old program that created back in the time when we had a farm crisis. We were trying to develop businesses out in the rural areas. Primarily, the focus was supposed to be rural. It has changed. My question to you is $1.2 million. How much does that buy medium, small companies in terms of an interest buy-down so that when they are making their plans, they can, rather than borrow $100,000, they could borrow $125,000 or $150,000 so they could by robotics rather than just a conveyor belt. So can you tell me and the rest of the committee, when we eliminate this, how much loan money are we kind of hurting these small businesses with?
Mr. Cream. Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a very good question, and I think, Representative, it's instructive, again, to go back to, as you noted, the beginning of the program when this program really focused on greater Minnesota. That has not been the case in the last 10 years. These loans, MIF loans, Minnesota Investment Fund loans, are made across the state We oftentimes make them to large companies. So you see larger companies like, most recently, I believe we'll be doing a loan to Federal Mogul in Lake City. This is a multi-million dollar company looking for some assistance. We're offering them also some other assistance in the form of training. But the program is no longer targeted specifically at small businesses around the state. When we look at other sources of funding for small businesses to enable them to gain access to low-interest funds, MIF is one resource. There's also the Small Business Administration, and I'm having a letter from the Southwest Regional Development Commission in southwestern Minnesota. It happens to be headquartered in Slayton, where I'll read the letter. SRDC, Southwest Regional Development Corporation, gap financing dollars are available for business. This was a direct mail to businesses throughout southwest Minnesota, essentially notifying them that this particular fund has excess capacity right now and has funds available to loan. One of the challenges with MIF, and I bring this up not to say that all areas of the state are equally well covered, but MIF is such a small, modest sum in terms of the total amount of commercial lending that happens on a statewide basis, that for those small businesses, if we assume that half of the loans we make in a given year are to smaller business, so that would be two, because we're making approximately 4 to 5 loans a year, I think there's plenty of other resources available for those businesses. And you are true, it is true, Representative. We typically make these loans at 1% to 2%. We're well below prime. But at the same time, the amount of lending that we do is minuscule compared to the commercial lending opportunities that are out there, as well as regional and other Minnesota Initiative Foundation lending pools that are available for businesses to leverage.
Representative Mahoney.
Yeah, and just in terms of the Southwest, the letter that you sent, it would be interesting to kind of go back and find out how that letter came to be, because as the economy is just starting to recover, manufacturing has certainly taken a substantial hit, and maybe the purpose of their letter, and certainly you nor I know what was going on in their minds and in their board when they decided to put the letter together, but it certainly could have been trying to focus on reviving the manufacturing community in the southwest part of the state, which, you know, they're paying better paying jobs than many jobs out in the rural area, which and they in many cases provide some benefits that help the state in other ways. I disagree with you that I think that this program should be reinstated and really pumped up because focused on rural and small businesses, the 5 to 10 employees trying to get to the 15 to 25 employees. But at this particular point, that's a discussion for later on in the committee hearings.
Well, Mr. Chair,
to that point,
yes. Yeah. I just had a question for the commissioner too, as far as do these funds in any way that Representative Mahoney's talking about, do they duplicate the effort done by the MAEDB program, which also appears to still be available? Are you familiar with that program? The Minnesota Agriculture and Economic Development Board? And could you explain the 25% amount that's available for funding, how that works?
Mr. Kramer. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Ag and Economic Development Board is part of the department, and historically, we have not used it for smaller loans. It's interesting because the Ag and Economic Development Board has been making much larger loans, typically in the $2 to $3 to $4 million range statewide. We have sufficient lending capacity, though, and I checked with our finance director yesterday, that we can target loans in the MIF range of the $100,000 to $200,000 to $300,000 range with no problems at all. I think the 25% that you may be referring to leads to, and I'm not sure if it's specific to the Ag and Economic Development Board, there are specific capital requirements that the business must show in terms of their own private investment before the state can invest. MIF has certain different criteria. So for a smaller business, it may well be true that there's a barrier to them using the Ag and Economic Development Board money because they have to come up with a certain amount of their own capital. However, I would suggest to members, as important as this program is, and I don't disagree with anyone who says that it's important, this was a hard choice for the department, we are confident that within our own capacity, we have sufficient funds to deal with all businesses in the state today. Going through our pipeline of available candidates and businesses and communities that have expressed interest, were we to award all of them, which invariably never happens, we would still have excess capacity to the tune of approximately $100,000. So it would burn us down almost to zero. But if we did every loan in the state that we've been asked to do right now, we would still have money left over. We have multiple other resources, and I've challenged our department that when communities bring forward businesses that are asking for assistance, we need to be much more aggressive at seeking local initiative foundations, local regional development organizations, and other services that can make their funding available. And oftentimes, members, these are also at far below prime rate interest.
Representative Gravel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could just rewind a bit back to page 7 on the eliminating the grant for the mortgage credit program. It says the background is this grant helps defray the cost of the to issue mortgage credit certificates.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I missed that. Can you tell me what that is?
Mr. Chair, Representative, only with a great deal of finessing on my part, this has essentially been a pass-through grant by the department for years, and I have a background here that was provided to me by MHFA that I truly would just be reading it. It might be more appropriate to ask Commissioner Marks to actually comment on the program itself. I have to confess, this has not been a program that we administer. We simply pass through the money to help the communities issue these. Mr. Chair, I'll simply read here. The aid is used to provide home ownership programs to people who are at or below 80% of the area median income. And there are three entities in the state who issue mortgage credit certificates. And then it says Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Dakota County. There's a note here regarding some specifics of the program in financial minutia. But the main point for me has been that none of these communities received any assistance in 03 or 04. The program is still going strong. They're still issuing mortgage credit certificates. We simply don't see the need for the pass-through at this time.
What is a mortgage credit certificate, though?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's where I need to ask MHFA to step in.
The sword is right here.
Good morning. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. A mortgage credit certificate is an alternative to mortgage revenue bond, and it is actually a certificate that is issued by what would have been the bond issuer to a home buyer. And the home buyer then works with the bank, gets a regular mortgage, and then uses that certificate to deduct as a use it as a credit against their income tax liability for the amount of interest they paid up to a maximum, which I believe is $2,000. So instead of most of us get, let me compare it to a mortgage revenue bond where the bond is, the proceeds are used to finance below market interest rate loans. So that the subsidy, if you will, comes from a below market rate loan. Instead of getting a below market rate loan, the home buyer is subsidized by getting a credit against their income tax liability up to a certain amount.
Okay.
What it does is it avoids the cost of issuing a bond.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Seeing more questions, you want to proceed?
Very well, Mr. Chair, members, on page 9, and I apologize, I have struggled with this for some particular reason, methamphetamine. I've been having trouble pronouncing it. Cleanup fund.
With that, too.
In a happy exception to our budget cutting, we're actually proposing adding $250,000 a year for both 06 and 07 to a fund administered by the Public Facilities Authority, which is within our department, to make loans to communities in the state that have a site, typically a home or a business, that has been contaminated through methamphetamine production. Many of these communities are financially stressed, and this loan would bridge them from that time during which the cleanup was completed before the property can be seized and ultimately resold and the loan repaid to the state. We believe, working with the Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, this will be sufficient for some 20 to 25 cleanups. The cleanup is relatively modest, approximately $10,000 or less in the vast majority of cases, but it will make it a consistent program across the state.
One thing I'd like to mention to the members is that this is not nearly enough money for what the total problem is. However, insurance companies from property owners do come first, and then this would come next to assist local governments in getting this done. So I think it's a very important new part. And we're one of the only states that do that. Yep. Iowa has a very unique way of taking care of this problem. Is called a match and a can of kerosene.
You're right.
I said it was unique, didn't I?
Mr. Chair. Thank you. On page 10, members, business and community development, we are proposing a variety of cuts in our business and community development unit. These cuts relate to just general operating expenses within the unit. Most notably, for approximately the last 10 years, the department has had a trade office in Japan staffed by not an employee of the state, but an individual we contract with as a resident of Japan to represent our interests there. We have been talking with that individual for the last year and prepping them for the fact that we did not wish to continue the relationship. In many other countries, we have honorary trade representatives. Typically, these are either companies that come from Minnesota that have individuals in those countries, or somebody with, and I'll use the term loosely, an alumni tie. They went to school here, they have some connection to Minnesota, and they act as an unofficial, unpaid representative for us. Members, while that's the most significant cut within the Business and Community Development Division, honestly, it's the least important from our perspective. Our trade across the country, across the globe, has continued to grow dramatically. And in fact, arguably, having a trade office in Japan, if one were to equate that with more aggressive trade, has not proven to be the case. Our trade with Japan has grown, but not as fast as in those countries that we don't have trade missions. I also looked at many other states. Wisconsin, for example, pays for 5 trade missions around the world. Our trade is growing at almost 1.25% faster than Wisconsin's. I don't consider this to be a detriment to the department in any way. In fact, it's a good cost savings. Members, I'll turn to page 11, which is state-funded administration, and these are our general administrative expenses. There are 4 principal cuts in this area, approximately $444,000 a year for $888,000 for the biennium. There is a general fund rent savings of $140,000 per year as a result of our new location. By combining 3 locations in downtown St. Paul, we were able to reduce our general rent expenses. Through our consolidation between the former DES and the former DTED, we now have sufficient IT personnel to manage the entire department. And as individuals have retired, we're simply not replacing them, so we have some savings there. Library consolidation. The 2 former departments managed between them 3 separate libraries for the benefit of professional development of staff. These are both technical libraries as well as general literature libraries in the specialty areas that we cover. We have now consolidated those operations into 1 location. There are reduced expenses simply from acquiring material. We have not laid anyone off in that department. We do expect that at least 1 of the librarians will be retiring through normal attrition, resulting in some additional cost savings. And then finally, our analysis and evaluation unit, the combination of the LMI unit, labor market information, which was part of the former DES, and analysis and evaluation, which was part of DTED, has resulted in some slight overlap, and we believe we need a couple of less people there. So there would be at least 2 layoffs associated with the cut that we're proposing for analysis and evaluation. Members, on page 12, this is a request to the legislature. We would like to add promotional authority to the department as a whole. The Minnesota Trade Office, through its original enabling legislation, always had the capacity to sell material that was produced at state expense. And so when the Minnesota Trade Office would create promotional material for the purposes of export, increasing exports, when they in turn sold that material to companies to assist them, or through our training activities, because today we run a very aggressive training program around the state, training companies in export, we're able to charge for those services, recover our costs, and put the funds back into an account for the Minnesota Trade Office. Today, in the department as a whole, we produce a great deal of material for the assistance of companies in the state on general recruitment activities in Minnesota, but when we hand it out, any funds we accrue go back to the state general fund, not the department. You can see it's a very modest amount of approximately $20,000 a year that we think would be very beneficial for the department. For instance, our Positively Minnesota brochure is in significant demand by companies. We typically end up giving that away or selling it for a very nominal cost today because we're simply giving the funds to the state general fund. When we have to produce more, then it's coming out of our additional budget. If we can charge for those funds, put them into an account for the department, we're able to produce more for the state and hand them out even faster. Members, on page 13, this is one of the principal activities I mentioned earlier. We are proposing some significant changes in the youth programs that the department administers. I noted it earlier, and I will say it again, these were not easy choices. I will not for a moment argue that these are not good programs, but in the grand scheme of the mission of the department and how we can best contribute to the economic success of the state, in our own scoring criteria, these scored near the bottom. There are 4 programs here. One of the cuts, and the cuts add up to approximately $6.5 million a year. I would note, members, that one of these cuts is not really a cut. It is a transfer of the youth intervention program. The youth intervention program works with early offenders in the juvenile justice system. It is funded at approximately $1.4 million a year, and we're proposing that that be transferred to the Department of Public Safety. So it's not really a cut. It's simply a movement between two state agencies. The intent of that is this is not an economic development program. It has some elements of training people on not a specific job, but how to work in a team environment, respecting authority, et cetera. But by and large, this is a program that targets making sure youth offenders, early offenders within the juvenile justice system have something to do. And so while it's a good program, it's not core to our mission. Of the three programs then that we are proposing, of the three programs we are proposing to cut, I'll run through them each individually here. The Minnesota Youth Program is by far and away the largest program. The Minnesota Youth Program is funded at approximately $4 million a year. The Minnesota Youth Program serves 3,829 individuals in the fiscal year 04. It has reasonably good results. It is served statewide through the Workforce Center system, so our Workforce Service Area partners around the state provide youth services. There's an annual report on our webpage that one can read. Again, recognizing that it does good work, but at the same time, the program in general is a summer-only program. Our WIA dollars, which is the Workforce Investment Act that we receive from the federal government, provides us with $10.5 million a year, and President Bush to date has not proposed significant cuts in that. Now, I would be honest, though, and tell members it's entirely possible the WIA Act is under reauthorization by Congress. The Minnesota delegation, on a bipartisan basis, is supporting the department in trying to ask for higher allocations. I won't bore the members with the formula, but it is a sad fact that Midwestern states with a good work ethic and a high workforce participation rate habitually score much lower in their formula allocations from the federal government than do other states with a lower workforce participation rate. For example, Mississippi, with almost half of our population, receives twice the youth, adult basic, and adult dollars that we earn, twice what we do here in Minnesota. So I'm not sure if our congressional delegation, again, on a bipartisan basis, will be successful. I suspect the Mississippi delegation is equally as fervent in preserving that, but we do hope for some activity at the federal side. The two other programs, one is specific to St. Paul. It is called Learn to Earn. Learn to Earn is a pass-through grant of approximately $360,000 for the biennium, $180,000 per year. Learn to Earn goes exclusively to the Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Department, so it is not a statewide program. And as I mentioned earlier, when I said these were tough choices, the Minnesota Youth Program is a statewide program. The other two programs we've identified are not statewide. They have the second one I'll talk about, Youth Build, has a statewide presence, but it is limited to specific communities. Learn to Earn is specifically a pass-through grant for Minneapolis Parks and Recreation. Last year, they served approximately 124 kids. The final program that we're proposing to cut is Youth Build. Youth Build is a program that helps individuals enter the construction trades. Last year, they served 254 individuals on a statewide basis. This program is statewide in the sense that they have service providers around the state, but these 10 service providers only work in specific communities. So say, for example, in northwestern Minnesota, there is one service provider in Bemidji. There's another one in the city of Perham. There are several service providers, three of them in the city of, or two in the city of St. Paul, one in the city of Minneapolis. There's also one serving Carver and Scott counties. The entire southwestern corner of the state, pretty much west central, has no service providers for Youth Build. As I mentioned, members, they served approximately 254 individuals in 04. This is, again, a good program. It has its own challenges. Only about a quarter of the individuals who work in Youth Build, and remember, this is the construction trades, about a quarter of them actually go on to work in the construction trades. Only about 84% of them actually complete the program. So about 20% of them drop out. Members, the last, or I'd open up for questions.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to put a question to you that my colleague Ken Clark brought up yesterday with one of the other testifiers. Do you have a cost analysis benefit for these particular programs? In the terms of what we're spending in terms of dollars versus the prevention of services later on, be it as court court services or social services of any one sort or another. If we pull 5 kids out of a life of crime, you know, we've already paid for the program for at least a year. You know, if you're talking, you've got 254 in one program, 124 in another, and I think it was 3,000 in the youth program. You know, have you done any of those? Do you have them, or do you plan on doing anything of that nature?
Commissioner Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do for one of the programs, the Youth Build Program, and again, its annual report is available on our website. We actually did the cost-benefit analysis the department did last year to analyze the effectiveness of the program, and indeed, it has about a 4-to-1 return, and a projected return, our own analysis, so an independent authority might find otherwise. But to your point, Representative, presumably, believing our own analysis, a dollar spent yields $4 in benefits in future going back to prison, going into criminal juvenile justice system, whatever the case may be. The Learn to Earn program with Parks and Recreation does not have a similar cost-benefit analysis. And quite frankly, Representative, not critical to the City of Minneapolis, but it is a very, very limited program, only to parks inside the City of Minneapolis. And I question why the state should be providing a specific pass-through for one community in the state. The Minnesota Youth Program serves 3,829 kids. It is a very good program. We do not have at the department level a cost-benefit analysis, nor have we been requested to do one. I would venture to say that a reasonable analysis would lead one to believe that there is a benefit associated with having individuals in this program. Their annual report is replete with examples of people who were struggling, having problems with juvenile justice, whatever the case may be, and working through this program feel very confident now in their outcomes.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Thanks for being here today. I too have some questions in this, and I'm happy to be serving my 5th year now, so I have a little bit of history, which I think is important when we're talking about these youth programs. Is there a way we can find out what has happened as far as funding of these youth programs over the last few bienniums? It's my recollection, if we go back a ways, they've been losing dollars in recent bienniums, and I would venture to guess that might be one of the reasons why these programs are, they're still doing well, but they're at the point now where we can say, well, they're not serving enough people in the state, and therefore they may not have as good statewide significance, therefore we may look at eliminating them. So I'm just wondering, past 2 or 3 bienniums, if there have been cuts, and if that potentially could be some of the reason. I can speak anecdotally that is the case in northeastern Minnesota. We've seen cuts to Youth Build, which has resulted in 2 things: less folks being served, and loss of jobs of the folks that have worked for Youth Build, which has had a direct hit on the economy just in that small portion. So I'm wondering if we can take a look back in the history and see how we got to this point in the 2006-07 budget.
Commissioner Kramer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, first of all, I would like to respond on Youth Build, but I will give you an example. The Minnesota Youth Program, which we are proposing to eliminate for this biennium, in 2003... distributed $2.8 million across all WSAs in the state. These are the workforce service areas. That number 2.8. In 2004, we distributed 3.9. It's actually went up almost $1 million. In 2005, these are the fiscal years, obviously, $3.9 million for a loss of just some $10,000. So the program has actually gone up in the last couple of years, just very modest reduction from 05 to 04. Mm-hmm. On Youth Build, the program has an impact on individuals. It certainly does. Certainly the obvious ones are the individuals working for Youth Build who administer the service. One of the comments I would make about Youth Build is that it's designed to, or it had a purpose early on of building assisted living housing, low-income housing for individuals around the state. Several of the Youth Build programs have, whether through circumstances or otherwise, end up working on nonprofit activities. And in the case of the Youth Build organization in your area, they've done extensive work at Iron World restoring buildings on the, the museum or the campus itself. So they don't have a direct economic impact in terms of the after effect of individuals moving into low income or renovated housing.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you. And I was directly talking to you, but moving over to the youth intervention program, transferring it to public safety, I'm more parochial in nature, but even in this committee, I just always tense up when we're sending our dollars from this committee budget over to another committee. I just hate doing that, especially when we're cutting a ton of money here. And we've done it all my third term here. We'll send money to different committees, and then we'll send money back to the general fund, and I think we shouldn't be doing that all the time. When you send youth intervention to public safety, I have a big concern about that, and I don't know if that's your rationale, public safety's rationale, the governor's office. I don't know who quite makes that call, who can answer that question. But part of your primary mission is to support the economic success of individuals. I would argue in youth build, even if 84%, and I think that's a significant number when you're talking about a population that is some of our more vulnerable students. I see that as a stronger success rate, one that we could improve on, but a stronger success rate. But when you're looking at individual success, maybe they're not going into the trades, but they're learning those skills that are going to make them economically successful individually, which I think goes right back to your primary objective. Youth intervention at the same time, while they might not be in a job training sort of atmosphere, I think my fear is transferring it to public safety, they're going to get lost in the mix over there, and I think it brings along stigma at the same time. Public safety is dealing with methamphetamines, sex offenders, all of these huge issues that are very labor-intensive for the agency and also financially intensive. My hope in this committee when we're discussing this, and I'd like your comments, Commissioner, on this, is that we potentially keep it here where we're trying to get these folks to work. If they're stuck over in public safety in the correctional system in that area, I think we do the program a disservice and the individuals impacted a disservice. To lump them in with sex offenders and the meth users, because I have trouble with that word. I just use meth, Commissioner, because that's easy to say. I just feel more comfortable with being here. Plus, we keep the dollars in this budget division.
Commissioner Kramer?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, this I guess my basic response to you was I don't disagree that if we take a very broad definition of economic success, it would certainly include like youth intervention program. My challenge is if we take a very broad definition, then on a parochial basis, I think MnDOT should report to our department because roads are infrastructure and infrastructure leads to economic development, and one could make the case for all state agencies and we would only have one commissioner reporting to you.
I'd tell you that though for you.
Yeah. with due apologies to MnDOT, the youth intervention program, we have talked about this with public safety. I'll read briefly. The youth intervention program works on restorative justice service, restitution, community service supervision, family group conferencing, victim offender mediation, pre-court diversion services, counseling, and then educational programs relating to specific offenses, theft, vandalism, alcohol, tobacco, and other drug offenses. This is not a core mission of DEED. And I think what happens is when we begin to broaden our charter, we end up with individuals working for DEED who essentially don't share the department's mission. And I've been very diligent in trying to limit the scope of our mission creep with inside DEED to be very specific and very targeted on economic development. This is a very good program. There is no criticism whatsoever intended in a transfer to public safety. And I would hope that the Department of Public Safety people would be able to assure you, Representative, that they would not lump these kids in with sex offenders or meth, and I will use the abbreviation, versus the more hardcore offenders.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm wondering if you could just explain briefly how we compare with other states for these programs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, 17 out of 50 states use state general fund dollars for youth programs. 33 do not. They use only their federal WIA, or they use a variation. And so many states use a portion of what are called TANF, and I'm sure most members are familiar with. TANF is temporary aid for needy families to fund a element of youth programs. But only 17 states have a general fund. Within that ranking of 17, I believe we're number 2 in terms of the amount of money we have put directly into youth programs. Again, no criticism is intended of these youth programs. We merely, in making our budget and looking at the core mission of DEED, felt that these programs, in terms of overall ranking, were near the bottom of the list.
Representative Nelson.
Commissioner, Chair, you mentioned about the success rate of the youth build. How does that compare with the other programs out there, like the apprenticeship programs and the training programs that are out there for youth? because there's not a, my understanding is of what I know about the apprenticeship programs, the success rate or the completion rate isn't high. A lot of people go into them thinking it's for them, and they're not qualified or cut out to working in the, those type of jobs. They don't have the skills necessary. How does that compare with the other programs that are out there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm afraid I can't comment specifically on the effectiveness of the apprenticeship programs. Those are in DALI, Department of Labor and Industry. There was a move afoot, I think, back in 03 to perhaps transfer apprenticeship to the then would have been DES, and I can't speak for why that didn't happen. There may be some logical reasons to ultimately link the two up. Within this program, they have reasonably positive outcomes. Much of Youth Build, remember, members, is focused on individuals who are having some challenges in their lives. These can be high school dropouts, people who are going through some juvenile justice issues or other situations. In 2004, 85% completed high school or obtained a GED. 81% ultimately entered unsubsidized employment, so they went into full-time employment. The average wage of unsubsidized employment was $10, just a hair over, so a reasonably good wage for somebody with a high school graduation. It's a solid program, but it's not specifically targeting, although it's in the construction trades, only about a quarter of the individuals ultimately go on to work in the construction trade. So I think that I would venture to say that the Youth Build's emphasis on construction, it could be any trade that they were really looking at. They simply use construction as a vehicle to bring kids together, work in a team environment. There's a real solid outcome in terms of you're building something or you're renovating something. And it's almost like the trades is simply the mechanism to achieve the team result.
Mr. Chair? So what they're doing is they're teaching them basic skills, getting to work on time, those type of things, which help them in any job they get into. They're not specifically going into trade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. As you might suspect, with Youth Build, many of the trades they learn are basic construction skills, you know, hammering, sawing, et cetera. It isn't the detailed trades of pipe fitter, welding, carpentry. These tend to be more entry-level, as evidenced by the unsubsidized wages. Youth Build also has a school component, and so individuals enrolled in Youth Build, if they're working towards a GED or high school degree, may be doing some portion of their Youth Build time in an education environment. Youth Build also has field trips to the extent that they take the kids out to specific job sites, to specific companies, look at what companies are looking for in individuals, how to basic work skills, showing up on time, attendance, etc.
Mr. Chairman.
Now, that's Senator Nelson.
I guess the question I had was, you said it was only a 25% success rate going into the trades.
Oh.
So they have a higher success rate than that. It's just that only 25 go on into the trades afterwards.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. Yeah, the success rate is very good, and I've got the numbers right in front of me. I kind of mentioned them in terms of 80% going into unsubsidized employment is a good number in any program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, on Youth Build, too, one of the questions that's going to come up is, will this program disappear without state funding? There are 10 service providers. It is funded to the tune of approximately $750,000 a year, so each service provider receives approximately $77,000 a year. Youth Build can continue, and in fact, today, Youth Build does get a significant non-state match or contribution. Private companies, construction companies, many companies participate in contributing to the Youth Build programs, oftentimes whether direct subsidies, there are construction companies or vendors that donate materials to Youth Build projects. Also the federal government, we competed for and won a $400,000 HUD grant associated with two projects, one in Representative Sertich's area and one in the city of St. Paul with Guadalupe Alternative Programs. Both of those federal programs can remain. We will have to work with the vendors to ensure that they raise the necessary non-state match to retain that federal money.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And that's the tricky part is when you it's like a house of cards. Much of what we do in here with federal pass-throughs and the state and local matches and private matches is we have this house of cards that if you pull the state funding, potentially there's the problem of trying to get HUD funding dollars or getting these businesses to stay on board. So just for the committee, more of a comment than a question is we've just got to be very mindful of when we pull state funding away and we say there's federal money available and there are private donations that sometimes, I'm not saying in this instance, but sometimes those matching dollars can go away as well.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just to follow up on Representative Sertich's comments, in the 02-03 biennium, the state obviously contributed approximately $1.4 million to the program. There were matching funds to the Youth Build program specifically of over $3 million. So the preponderance of funds they receive is non-state.
Representative Follett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I have a question that's probably a little more philosophical, which is, I guess, the underlying reason of what we're cutting and what we're doing. Now, as I understand it, you're explaining that you took the core mission of the department, it's the new slim, trim department, and what doesn't fit is excess weight and is going in this. Did the governor direct you to make certain amount of dollar cuts, and then you had to make that fit, or is it just everything that didn't fit in the core went, or, you know, there's this trend of, are we cutting because we don't meet the budget, are we reforming government, because once these programs go, it's almost impossible to get that funding back, and I just wondered, or is it the there was some process that all the departments went through of introspection and trying to figure it out. So where did, I'm just wondering how this prioritized.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did not have a number assigned to us by the governor whatsoever. The department, like all state agencies, was requested by the Department of Finance to go through a priority setting exercise where we ranked all of our activities in a 20-60-20 model. 20% being the highest programs, those with greatest value to the state, 60% being the bulk of the programs in the middle, and then 20% being those programs, important as they might be, that were less core to the central mission of the department. And programs that we have on the cut list today that we are recommending to the legislature fall in that bottom 20%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slotwick.
Just a follow-up. So 20-60-20, 20 high priority, 60 mid, and then 20 was for cuts, was a model that was followed by all agencies or departments?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's my understanding the Department of Finance had all state agencies go through this exercise. I would add, though, that just because a program is in the bottom 20% does not mean that it was targeted for cuts. Members will be aware that within our budget, we also provide services in vocational rehabilitation and in state services for the blind. And members, some of these programs, quite frankly, from a return on investment, may ultimately score lower than perhaps youth programs, but there's a social cost associated with training somebody who is severely disabled or perhaps blind, and the costs associated with preparing that individual for unsubsidized employment so that they can get on with their life, have a productive contribution to not only their own social situation but to the economy as a whole, might ultimately be much higher than that associated with one youth. So we have to make both a economic trade-off as well as a social trade-off.
Oh, Mr. Chair, this, I guess so, social trade-off, economic trade-off, but in there we don't do the people trade-off, do we? I guess that just doesn't factor in. So you have to, those are all the different things that you're weighing, right? So social, economics, and then 20, bottom 20%, and then the cut.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I'm confused by your comment about we don't think about the people. We think about the people a great deal. For example, Representative, within state services for the blind, we have two distinct populations we serve. We serve youth. These are individuals who, for whatever reason, are experiencing loss of sight. On a quantitative basis, youth have a long time to live. And so getting them set up in life, understanding how they're going to achieve their goals in life, whatever it may require significant investment, but it has a significant long-term investment. We also serve as our secondary population, senior citizens, who many senior citizens and many of us at some point in our life will experience what is called macular degeneration, which is a natural loss of eyesight that happens as one grows older. Purely from an economic development perspective, you would look at that population and say they are in many cases retired. They are not contributing directly to the economy. On an ROI basis, one could very callously say, let's cut that population and not provide services. We look at people in every decision we make.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just going to follow up a little bit on Representative Sertich's comments about part of the problem is that when we take away a state match, the private industry says that, you know, or private donors say, well, where's the state's part? Because my question is to the vice chair of this particular committee, how many times have you heard as a member of the, also a member of the bonding committee, we can't get private dollars unless we get this, unless we know what the state's going to give. Quite often comes up. So, you know, as Representative Sertich just was putting out there, that if we take away state dollars, we may not get the construction industry, the manufacturing industry, and the other industries that you mentioned to step forward with their particular dollars also. And just as an aside, I actually spent an extended period of time this fall working with one of the people that came to Youth Build this was a young man that had a tremendous amount of trouble in his youth. Some of it still followed him a little bit because we were on a military base and needed to get authorization to get on, and he had some problems with that. But several years as a pipe fitter, enjoying life and buying a house in South Minneapolis. So it's a good program, and I hope we can figure out a way to make sure it stays going.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't disagree with Representative Mahoney's characterization. The program is a good program, and its outcomes are very solid.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I don't want to put you too much on the spot because it's not my intention to have you say something bad about anything that you're cutting, because I think you've made the point multiple times, and I'll repeat it for you so you don't have to this time. These are worthwhile programs that are on the chopping block here that serve a purpose, that may be different philosophy than the administration and yourself, but they serve a purpose somewhere in the world. And I know that you answer to a higher power, and those aren't capitalized, those words. I mean, the governor here. But in discussing state services for blind and for those folks that have impaired vision, you talked a bit about the youth, that that they're going to be in the workforce for a long time, so there's this need to make sure that we get them off on the right foot as far as being into the workforce. How, in your mind, is that different than the youth that are involved in the youth intervention programs and youth build? Those services, much of the job training services for the folks that have impaired vision are not, you know, how to write a resume and those sorts of things. It's how to get to work on time, how to move around. Where is the distinction or the difference between the at-risk youth and the youths with impaired vision?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative. In 2003, the last year for which we have full statistics, our LMI unit, labor market information, estimated that there are approximately 299,000 youths, this is ages 16 to 19, in the state of Minnesota, of which approximately 160,000 engage in employment. That means that of the total youth programs, Minnesota Youth Program, Youth Build, and Learn to Earn, we serve about 1.75% of all youth in the state. The other 98.25% go out and gain gainful employment on their own with no state services. And so to answer your question, I look at this and say our ability to impact somebody with degenerative vision issues and assist them is markedly different from dealing with an extraordinarily small subset of the overall youth population. There are no other services for people who have impaired vision. State services for the blind is the service. For individuals who, through whatever situation may occur, whether it is their own fault or not their own fault, are experiencing a tough time as a youth, juvenile justice, drugs, teenage pregnancy, whatever the case may be, I hesitate to say this because it sounds quite callous, but there is a solution, and that is to work. And for many of them, employment does exist and it will exist in their lifetime. For somebody who has vision issues, the alternative is to deal with them very early and assist them in their own in achieving their own economic objectives.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kramer, I'm on pages 24, 25, and 26 in the book here, and I was just, you know, I get that question here on the jobs created part of MIP and Urban Initiative Program. You know, it shows that there's a substantial reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell me what's causing that? Is that a direct relationship to the funding that's available, or have those been moved to the jobs deals? You or some other department?
Commissioner?
Mr. Representative, it appears on the faces of it, as you noted, to be a market decrease. If we look at the historical patterns, though, MIF is up and down in any given year in dramatic swings because it directly relates to the number of businesses seeking capital from the state. It also relates to the visibility of the program. In years past, I can't speak to 2002, but I know that in 1998, the program was funded at almost $6 million a year. There was much more money, so there was much more activity. So the reduced funding simply appears to be, are we creating less jobs? Plus, also, there's less loan demand. It also helps, but having gone through the recession, there's less demand for capital as well. So we really need to look at the numbers over the continuum of the program, and in any given year, there's wild swings. There really is no statistical correlation.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, on page 26, too, it
PFA manages assets in excess of $1.5 billion. Can you tell me how does that happen, or what causes that? Is that in buildings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mayor, this is in binding authority for the Public Facilities Authority for wastewater, drinking water, and transportation. Transportation was my understanding. This was a rather limited program some years ago. We don't really use that anymore. But the PFA bonds for communities across the state to do wastewater and drinking water facilities so that those assets are in the bonds that we hold.
Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I do want to say, you know, I've been here four terms. I used to come and watch members beat up on commissioners and feel bad about it, so I'm sorry. We try not to do that, and I've seen many a member do it, and it's just we get frustrated with the cuts. But I do have a question. Can we get a copy of the rankings? That how you ranked your programs, the 20-60-20?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I assume we can. I will certainly check with finance.
I'd like to get that.
Please.
Members, I'm going to turn to page 14 in your budget book, then, which is our last recommendation. This is not a general fund cut. This is the Workforce Development Fund, and we're proposing elimination of the Displaced Homemaker Program. The Displaced Homemaker Program serves, as it says, primarily women, although it could conceivably be men, who have been out of the workforce for some time, typically in a single-income family with the man or woman working and the spouse staying at home, and now are reentering the workforce. This funding comes out of the State Dislocated Worker Program. It is not a statewide program. It is limited to, I believe, 40 of the counties in the state of Minnesota today. And what's interesting is the State Dislocated Worker legislation at both the state and the federal level already contains language that says displaced homemakers fully qualify for State Dislocated Worker benefits. State Dislocated Worker benefits are substantially the same as displaced homemakers. It is job counseling. It can be assistance with child care, with transportation, and job training. So if an individual is training in a particular career. So when we talk about eliminating this, what we're talking about is simply retaining the $200,000 per year in the State Dislocated Worker Program and using that exact same money to serve displaced homemakers statewide. It's instructive for me to look at this program and say, given that the program today serves slightly more than half the counties, one would assume that half the counties already are serving displaced homemakers who appear at a workforce center, fully qualify for the State Dislocated Worker Program, and gain a set of services.
Any further questions for the commissioner? Representative Westerberg?
I just have a, I don't know, maybe it's a statement or not really a question. Well, I guess it is a question. As far as how would you say, since the jobs program is not treated here, or is it treated here anywhere significantly, or because it appears that it's, you know, handled in the Department of Revenue now, not here anymore?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not a specific issue in our budget, but it's still administered and run by our department. Communities around the state apply for Job Z designation or use Job Z designated land. They work with local businesses. There's a business subsidy agreement, which is a contractual agreement between the community and the business that is supervised by the state so that we make sure businesses achieve this. All those functions are done within the department, and we're not requesting any additional funds to run the program.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Kramer, then the results of the jobs program, you'll be letting us know what's happening with that and how it's working, and we'll see something from your department.
Mr. Chair, Representative, very shortly, they're working on a report to the legislature right now. We had, I believe it's in legislation that we say we will report each year on all Job Z deals, the nature of the job creation, et cetera, and that will be shortly delivered.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more of a question for the chair sitting to your left there. I always thought he was a little bit more left than you, but if he's going to compliment me, call me a conservative, you know. Mr. Chair, when this report comes, are we going to be able to have a hearing or at least some time in committee to have a conversation about the Job Z's?
Representative Guthrie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, certainly if that's the desire of the committee, we certainly would. I think it begs a lot of questions. Why is it more successful in one area than the other? And And I think that discussion would be very encouraged by me, and I think the committee would like to hear a lot of new members, and we want to make a committee hearing on it.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, one of the interesting things, and as many of the members on this committee know, that I've spent more time than I sometimes care to admit on jobs these, one of the really interesting things that would be good for us to hear is the, because there's, I think, about 200 projects that have gone through, how the department is putting a cost analysis per job, because I have asked that question time and time again. I've asked it in New York, I've asked it in Pennsylvania, I've asked it in Michigan, and I've asked it of the departments there, and I cannot get a question, and I suspect Minnesota is so much smarter than those other three states that we would be able to come up with a formula to give us whether each job is costing us $1,000 or $80,000. So look forward to that, Mr. Chair and Mr. Commissioner. I look forward to that dollar figure, that formula that you're going to be using.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, I'm sure the appropriate person sitting at the testifying table to bring us that information, and I as a big supporter, as you know, of the biggest job zone in the state called the Bioscience Zone, I'm very much aware of what we hope and anticipate will happen with that also. I look at that as, in my opinion, as being perhaps the biggest incubator of jobs that we have looking forward in the future of Minnesota. I think job zones in total throughout greater Minnesota is targeting jobs to where they're needed most, where the average family income is perhaps 60% of what it is in the metro area. So we're looking forward to both of those.
Representative Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is just a request for information part of the commissioner, but I'm aware that the Attorney General made a ruling related to the job zones requiring prevailing wage be paid for any of the projects for even private employers. And if the department has come up with any kind of analysis on how that impacts the decision-making of employers that are looking at possibly moving jobs to the state, and what kind of negative impact that would have on those decisions. So if you happen to have anything, I'd like to see it, or whatever your input is on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the department on our webpage on JobZ has several pieces of guidance to zone administrators and businesses, educating them on the Attorney General's ruling and the need to fully comply with prevailing wage requirements in the state of Minnesota. Much of prevailing wage continues to be very anecdotal. There is said to be a huge cost or a huge added cost. It has been our experience when we sit down with a business and actually look at the expenses, in general, it is not a significant decision-making item in their decision whether or not to use JobZ or, for that matter, accept state assistance. So remember, members, that MIF and our other loan programs typically incorporate prevailing wage information as well. So as a general tool in state assistance to business, prevailing wage has been linked to the vast majority of our programs. I am aware of at least two large engagements that we have in the state right now where the requirement for prevailing wage might ultimately be a decision on the part of the business not to use it, but these tend to be the very, very big projects where prevailing wage truly will add potentially several million dollars more in construction costs. But for the vast majority of our JobZ deals to date, it has not proven to be a significant barrier.
Seeing no other questions for the Commissioner, thank you for the overview today.
Thank you.
For committee members' information, tomorrow we'll be hearing from we'll be having a programming and budget overview from the Department of Human Services. If there's no other information, the committee will be adjourned.